All right, I'd like you to take your Bible this morning and turn to Romans chapter 8. When we do it God's way, He wants us to be the head and not the tail. In the next two messages, we're going to talk more about how the kingdom will be ours once again.
Welcome to Mission to Israel, a broadcast ministry featuring author, teacher, and evangelist Ted R. Weiland. The focus of this ministry is to open the eyes of our people and give insight into the issues we find ourselves facing in this day and age. Our address is Mission to Israel, Post Office Box 248, Scotts Bluff, Nebraska 69363, or you can reach us via the web at www.missiontoisrael.org. And now, here is Ted Weiland.
Chuck Baldwin's latest internet commentary, which was October 30th, which was last Tuesday, was entitled, Christians Should Support the Constitution. At one point in this long commentary, in fact, what was his speech on October 25th to the National Committee of the Constitution Party, he also declared that, quote, pastors especially should fight for constitutional government, end of quote. What do you think? Well, hopefully, anyone who has been listening up to this point through this many messages is now equipped to see through such nonsense. And if in the past you've been a pastor or a Christian who supported or promoted the Constitution, have already repented of your spiritual schizophrenia, of trying to serve two masters at the same time, which is impossible, of essentially what was your idolatry. Later, regarding oaths of office, Baldwin wrote this. He said, quote, genuine believers are to be true to their word. How then could a true Christian make a promise before God and the American people to preserve, protect, and defend the U.S. Constitution and then turn around and ignore that promise? Now, that's a good question. That is a good question. But it's the wrong question. Instead, we should be asking, how can a genuine Christian who truly believes in Psalms 19:7 that Yahweh's law is perfect, and in 2 Timothy 3:16 and 17, and what we find therein, ever make such a vow in the first place? This is a good question, but it's the wrong question. And we've been asking the wrong question now for over 200 years, one of many. In the next paragraph, he wrote, quote, therefore, a professing believer who is elected to public office and then ignores his or her promise to the Constitution proves that he or she is not a true Christian, but a phony who only uses religious testimony to dupe Christians, end of quote. No. The person claiming to be a Christian with his hand on the perfect law of Yahweh, who promises, takes an oath to uphold the imperfect laws of we the people, of the imperfect and often contrary laws of we the people, is the phony. More so than the one that he described. As were clearly the constitutional framers, many of whom on one hand claimed to be Christians while constructing a government that was humanistic, pluralistic, polytheistic, and even anti-Christian. Jeremiah chapter 2, verses 8 and 13 says the following. It says, The priest said not, where is Yahweh? And they that handle the law knew me not. The pastors also transgressed against me, and the prophets prophesied by Baal. In this case, a Baal called we the people. And walked after the things that do not profit. And then in verse 13 it says, for my people have committed two evils. They have forsaken me, the fountain of living waters, and hewed them out cisterns, broken cisterns that can hold no water. End of quote. A broken cistern that cannot hold water. Hasn't history proven that that is precisely what the Constitution of the United States of America has been? A cistern that could not hold any water. The results, the consequences are all around us and prove that to in fact be the case. This will be Bible Law versus Constitutionalism, Part 18. In the last message, I addressed Amendment 2, particularly the last phrase, quote, the right of the people to keep and bear arms, end of quote. I discussed how the very fact that nearly all ardent gun enthusiasts hang their hat on Amendment 2 as their authority for possessing firearms is indicative that the deity of the Bible, Yahweh, is not their God. That's really what that proves. Because whoever or whatever is your authority is your God. And thus, because they hang their hat on the authority of the amendment of Amendment 2, that phrase in Amendment 2, it proves that the deity of the Bible is not their God, but instead the deity of the Constitution, we the people, is their God. Their authority, their God, can be trespassed. Those who want to hang that the authority to bear arms on Amendment 2 of the Constitution, that their authority, their God, can be traced back to 1787. But where, I ask you, did the men living in America prior to 1987 get their authority to be armed in self-defense? See, we look at 1787, and we look at that Second Amendment, we all look back to that point in history and as if that's the beginning of that right. But where did the men before 1787 get their right for self-defense, to be armed in self-defense, and in defense of their families, and in defense of their communities, and even in defense of their nation when and if it was threatened? Where did they get their authority? Well, don't you suspect? I suspect that they got it from Exodus 22, 2 and 3, Deuteronomy 22, 23 and 24, Psalms 149, 6 and 9, Luke 11, 21, 12, 39, 22, 36, and 1 Timothy chapter 5 and verse 8. And amongst some others probably in the Old and New Testament that I haven't mentioned. Just like those before circa 1870, when the first state marriage license was issued, got their authority to be married from Genesis chapter 2, 21 and 24, etc. Why suddenly, think about this, why suddenly in circa 1870, and 1787 did what was previously lawful by Yahweh's standards suddenly become illegal without a state marriage license and the authorization of Amendment 2? Why? It was lawful before that. People had the authority to do it. They did it. And all of a sudden, both of those, without a state marriage license, just as an example of the other, and the authorization of Amendment 2, suddenly became illegal. Think about that. There is only one answer to that question. Only one answer. And the answer is because a new God and his ambassadors and his servants obviously did not think that Yahweh and his authority was sufficient, and thus did not recognize him and his all-encompassing authority, and who consequently filled the vacuum that they themselves had created by setting up a replacement God as their authority, just like their disciples do today, who look to the state for the authorization to be married and Amendment 2 for their right to be armed. They have surrendered Yahweh, the God of the Bible, for we, the people, the God of the Constitution. With that, let's look at Amendment 3. Amendment 3 says, no soldier shall, in time of peace, be quartered in any house without the consent of the owner, nor in time of war, but in a manner to be prescribed by law. Now, although perhaps not immediately apparent, this amendment, this particular amendment, Amendment 3, is already covered by the following biblical case law. Let's turn to Deuteronomy chapter 24. And again, this may not be immediately apparent, but realizing that these laws, while specific to those living at the time, were also case laws setting precedent for however and wherever it can be applied in any generation or at any time. Please look at this, and I think you'll see that indeed that basically Amendment 3 is already covered. Deuteronomy chapter 24, I'm not quite there yet, sorry. And look at verses 10 and 11 with me. Verse 10, it says, when thou dost lend thy brother anything, thou shalt not go into his house to fetch his pledge. Thou shalt stand abroad, or outside, and the man to whom thou dost lend shall bring out the pledge abroad, or outside, unto thee. Now, no matter how humble, think about this, no matter how humble, as the saying goes, a man's home, it is still his castle. And under Yahweh's perfect laws, it's his property, not the government's. Under Yahweh's perfect laws. And as such, the homeowner is protected by this statute from all unwanted and uninvited intruders, including soldiers. Soldiers aren't mentioned here, but the precedent, the principle of that verse makes it clear that that is his home, his property, and no uninvited or unwanted intruders are allowed therein. The same Eighth Commandment statute that we just read there in Deuteronomy 24 also already covers what's delineated in Amendment 4, which says the following, the right of the people to be secure in their persons, houses, papers, and effects. This one's really right, just almost as if it came right from there. I'll have to admit that. The right of the people to be secure in their persons, houses, papers, and effects against unreasonable searches and seizures shall not be violated, and no warrants shall issue but upon probable cause supported by oath or affirmation, and particularly describing the place to be searched and the persons or the things to be seized. And so that Eighth Commandment statute already covers those particular two amendments. Now, it needs to be pointed out, there's something very important here that certainly needs to be considered in regards to these two amendments, although they are already covered by biblical law. It needs to be pointed out that while Amendment 3 and Amendment 4 were already essentially law long before 1787, they are nonetheless two examples where that can be used for where an existing biblical government, a theocracy, might choose to further delineate the law of Yahweh in order to clarify or apply it to specific situations pertinent to the times that we might find ourselves living in. But, as it might be an elaboration of that law, an application of the law, but they would not be new law. Because only Yahweh can make law. They can't be new law. If they're law, they're simply the law as it already was, or an application of that law pertinent to the times. They'd simply be specifications or applications of Yahweh's existing laws. And I think this is two good cases where there is some application, and that can still be used today as applications, that if we were existing under Yahweh's law, under a theocracy, we very may want to even borrow some of that language as application for our times, for that particular case law found in Deuteronomy 24. However, if I had anything to do with it, if I were there and I had anything to do with it, the men involved in writing the specifications or applications would not be deemed legislators, but instead administrators or applicators, or perhaps somebody had come up with something better than either even those two, in deference and in reverence to Yahweh, the only lawgiver, the only legislator, as per Isaiah 33:2 and James chapter 4 and verse 12. There is only one legislator. There is only one lawgiver. Those things would be simply applications. They would not be new law. And therefore, such men under such a government should not in any fashion, in deference and reverence to Yahweh, be called legislators. All right. Let's move on to Amendment 5 then. No person shall be held to answer for a capital or other infamous crime unless on a presentment or indictment of a grand jury, except in cases arising in the land or naval forces or in the militia, when in actual service in time of war or public danger, nor shall any person be subject for the same offense to be twice put in jeopardy of life or limb, nor shall be compelled in any criminal case to be witness against himself, nor be deprived of life, liberty, or property without due process of law, nor shall private property be taken for public use without just compensation. All right, that's pretty long, so let's break that down into more manageable portions. Let's begin with the first phrase, which says, no person shall be held to answer for a capital or other infamous crime unless on the presentment or indictment of a grand jury. Well, yeah, hopefully you already know what the next question is going to be. Where in Yahweh's perfect laws do we find anything about grand juries? Now you might say, well, I still think they're a good idea. Well, they may be in certain situations. But we're not talking about just certain situations. We're talking about Yahweh's design, His desire, under His perfect laws, under His theocracy, with Him as King. And therefore, where do we find, in Yahweh's perfect laws, anything about grand juries? And of course, we don't find anything in Yahweh's laws about grand juries, and therefore, grand juries, plain and simple, are unbiblical. This is another case of where the Constitution is unbiblical when it comes to this amendment. Furthermore, when things are done in accordance with Yahweh's judicial mandates, grand juries, as a safeguard as they may have been intended and as in certain situations they may be, when we do it God's way, grand juries are totally 100% unnecessary. Instead of grand juries, what did God choose instead of grand juries? What did he choose for us to do, or how was it to be handled? Nothing about grand juries. Instead of grand juries, Yahweh requires, and this is, I think, hopefully you'll see that there's more to this than just how I'm going to state it initially. But instead of grand juries, Yahweh requires two or more witnesses. Let's turn to the passage that dictates that for us, Deuteronomy. We're already there, Deuteronomy chapter 17. Deuteronomy chapter 17 and verse 6. Verse 6, it says, at the mouth of two witnesses or three witnesses, and of course, or more witnesses, shall he that is worthy of death be put to death. But at the mouth of one witness, or a grand jury, you might say, he shall not be put to death. Two or more witnesses. Two or more witnesses who must be so convinced of their testimony that along with the blood avengers are prepared to be the leading participants in the execution of the one, not just bystanders, but leading participants in the execution of the one against whom they testified. Look at Deuteronomy 17:7. Let's just read verse 6 and 7 together. It says, "At the mouth of two witnesses or three witnesses shall he that is worthy of death be put to death. But at the mouth of one witness he shall not be put to death." Verse 7, "The hands of the witnesses shall be first upon him to put him to death, and afterward the hands of all the people, so thou shalt put the evil away from among you." Furthermore, these witnesses under God's system and His perfect laws would understand also prior to their testimony that if they perjure themselves, that is, if their testimony is found to be intentionally falsified, that they themselves would be or will be put to death in place of the one that they testified against. In fact, let's read that as well. Deuteronomy chapter 19, a couple chapters over, beginning with verse 16. Deuteronomy 19, beginning with verse 16, it says, "If a false witness rise up against any man to testify against him that which is wrong, then both the men between whom the controversy is shall stand before Yahweh, before the priests and the judges, which shall be in those days. And the judges shall make diligent inquisition, and behold, if the witness be a false witness, and hath testified falsely against his brother, then shall you do to him," verse 19, "as he hath had thought to have done unto his brother, so shall thou put the evil away from among you. And those which remain shall hear and fear, and shall henceforth commit no more any such evil among you." That's called deterrence. And then verse 21, "And thine eye shall not pity," you shall not pity a false witness under God's laws, "and thine eye shall not pity, but life shall go for life. Eye for eye, tooth for tooth, hand for hand, and foot for foot." It's called the law of lex talionis, or the law of retribution, provided many times in God's laws. Now, with those safeguards in Yahweh's laws against perhaps somebody being put to death wrongly, would some get away? You only got one witness. Every capital crime, you know, and people are going to point this out, but every capital criminal who only has one witness against him would get away. It's a safeguard, though, to make sure that the innocent, it's a safeguard to help preserve the innocent, that he isn't put to death. And therefore, it takes two or three witnesses. Witnesses, again, who must be willing, so convinced that they're willing to be the leading participants in the execution, and also willing to die themselves if indeed their testimony is proven false. And with those safeguards in place, think about it. Grand juries, people who are outside of the facts, would be totally superfluous, totally unnecessary. This is just another, this amendment, or this provision in this amendment, is just another instance of where the framers decided that they knew better than Yahweh, and thereby rejected Yahweh's perfect laws. If grand juries were necessary, you can bet God would have designed it and put them in place within His system. They're unnecessary, not when it's done right. By the way, because there are no stipulations on the number of times that a grand jury can be convened, a prosecuting attorney can, and they have, they can keep calling up grand juries until he finally gets one to decide on the case the way he wants it to, so that it can be prosecuted. Yeah, but somebody's going to say, what about one of the following phrases where it says, "Nor shall any person be subject for the same offense to be twice put in jeopardy of life or limb," end of quote. Has no bearing on grand juries. But what about that phrase? You know, you talk about superfluous. That's superfluous. After a trial, think about this. After a trial with two or more witnesses, in most instances, either the capital offender or the false witnesses are put to death. They don't go to prison. They're put to death. Consequently, there would be no one to try again, or there would be no witnesses left by which to try the case again. So it's a superfluous statement when it comes to God's laws. The very last phrase of Amendment 5 also needs to be scrutinized, where it says, quote, "Nor shall private property be taken without just compensation," end of quote. To begin with, you might want to consider that this provision is never applied to those who refuse to pay unbiblical and scurrilous property taxes. Never is applied to them. When the sheriff shows up to remove someone's property, he's not going to compensate that person with market value for their home and land. Not going to happen. But the county will graciously provide you with room and board. One place that this provision is applied is with eminent domain. Now, you all know what eminent domain is, don't you? Eminent domain is nothing more than a highfalutin phrase for organized theft. That's what it is. Micah chapter 2, verses 1 and 2. It says, "Woe to them that devise iniquity and work evil on their beds. When the morning is light, they practice it, because it is in the power of their hand." They practice it because they can. "And they covet fields, and they take them by violence, and houses, and take them away. So they oppress a man and his house, even a man and his heritage," or his progeny, end of quote, who would, under God's law, automatically, without exception, inherit the house and the land of his forefather. Turn with me to Deuteronomy chapter 19, or back to 19 if you're still in Deuteronomy. I guess we were in 19, but back to verse 14 in this case. In verse 14 it says, "Thou shalt not remove thy neighbor's landmark, which they of old time have set in thine inheritance, which thou shalt inherit in the land of Yahweh thy God, in the land that Yahweh thy God giveth thee to possess it." First part again says, "Thou shalt not remove thy neighbor's landmark." Eminent domain, the government's so-called right to seize property for the quote-unquote betterment of the people as a whole, is one way by which, not the only way, but is one way by which the government moves boundary markers and steals from its citizens. Bouvier's Law Dictionary defines eminent domain in Volume 1 on page 1008 in part as follows. Quote, "The superior," listen to this closely, "the superior right of property subsisting in a sovereignty." We're going to come back to that word sovereignty in another definition. But it says, "The superior right of property subsisting in a sovereignty, by which private property may in certain cases be taken or its use controlled for the public benefit, without regard to the wishes of the owner." Later it says, "The right of every government to appropriate, otherwise than by taxation and police authority," or in other words, in addition to taxation and police authority, "private property for public use." End of that quote from Bouvier's Law Dictionary. What's that sound like to you? Sounds like theft. Yeah, but somebody's going to say, yeah, but they said appropriate, you know, the right of the government to appropriate. Listen, appropriate is just a fancy word for stealing, and eminent domain, so-called, is just an impressive term for legalized plunder. Now, think about this. Because there is no exception clause in Deuteronomy 19:14, no individual, we automatically see that, no individual or collective body of individuals has the authority to steal land by moving the boundary markers. Regardless of the reason. You know, they can make the reason sound. Thief that's hungry, boy, he can make it sound like he's got good reason to steal from you. You know, regardless of the reason, there is no exception clause in Deuteronomy 19:14. In Frederick Bastiat's wonderful book, insightful book, The Law, I believe I didn't look this up for sure, but if my memory serves me correctly, written back in France in the 1700s and still just as applicable today as it was in the day he wrote it. In his book, he at one point he stated the following. He says, but because we're talking about, we automatically see that it applies. You're not, you know, Herschel's not allowed to move my boundary markers and I'm not allowed to move his. But we don't often apply it when it comes to eminent domain. We often don't see that application. Think about this from Frederick Bastiat. He says, quote, but how is legal plunder to be identified? How is legal plunder to be identified? Quite simply, see if the law takes from some persons what belongs to them and gives it to other persons to whom it does not belong. And then particularly the next phrase, he says, see if the law benefits one citizen at the expense of another by doing what the citizen himself cannot do without committing a crime. If such a law, which may be in an isolated case, is not abolished immediately, it will spread, multiply, and develop into a system, which is exactly what we have today. But they cover it up with all these highfalutin words, eminent domain and appropriation and all of these things, taxation. When in fact it's nothing, if you can test it, if it's illegal for the individual and the government does it, no matter what they call it, that's the test to see indeed if it's legalized plunder. Legalized plunder, what a term. But that, in fact, is what indeed it is. If you think about it, all of America has been stolen via eminent domain. All of it. Most people are unaware that eminent domain confers ownership of all the land to the government, not just what it appropriates at any given time, but all of the land through eminent domain is conferred to the government. Although government covers up its theft by paying, in this instance, not what the owner thinks, but what the government thinks is just compensation for the land it appropriates, thanks to Amendment 5, it ultimately can seize any citizen's land at its discretion. Can it not? If it decides, it's got a good case for it. Got good reason to do it for the quote-unquote benefit of the people. And boy, we've had some cases here in the last few years that prove it. They can do it for any reason. But it's worse than this. In Ruling Case Law, edited by William M. McKinney and Burdett A. Rich, they put it this way, quote, eminent domain as exercise of sovereignty. Eminent domain as exercise of sovereignty. That last word, sovereignty, interpret it deity. Eminent domain as exercise of deity, of a sovereignty. They go on, it was the theory of Grotius that the power of eminent domain was based on the principle. Now listen very closely. It was the theory of Grotius that has now certainly been adopted here in America, that the power of eminent domain was based on the principle that the state had an original and absolute ownership of the whole property possessed by the individual members of it. Ownership versus possession. Antecedent to their possession, in other words, before their possession, and that their possession and enjoyment of it being subsequently derived from a grant by the sovereign, the deity, it was held subject to a tacit agreement or implied reservation that it might be resumed and all individual rights to it extinguished by the rightful exertion of this ultimate ownership by the state. End of quote. Now listen. Because only Yahweh is sovereign. Only He holds eminent domain to all lands. To all of it. He's the only sovereign. Exodus, as dictated in Exodus 19:5, Leviticus 25 and 23, and several other passages throughout Old and New Testament alike. Therefore, here's where it gets worse. Therefore, any government claiming domain breaks not only the eighth commandment, but also the second commandment by putting itself in the place of God. Only God has sovereign domain. And no government, no collective force of individual men have the right to do what individual men could never do. And don't be fooled that the government seldom exercises its claim to eminent domain does not make it any less a reality. The fact that government can and does exercise eminent domain anytime and anywhere it chooses proves it has stolen all title to all land in America and has thereby replaced Yahweh's sovereignty with its own, a self-ordained authority or sovereignty. Kind of sounds like the opening three words of the preamble, doesn't it? We the people. We the state. We the government. We are the sovereignty. But, not to worry. Thanks to Amendment 5 of the Constitution, you'll be compensated for the land you never wanted to quote-unquote sell in the first place. But they'll compensate you. They'll compensate you with what they want to compensate you, not what you want to be compensated by. All right, moving on. Amendment 6. It says, in all criminal prosecutions, the accused shall enjoy the right to a speedy and public trial by an impartial jury of the state and district wherein the crime shall have been committed, which district shall have been previously ascertained by law, and to be informed of the nature and cause of the accusation, to be confronted with the witnesses against him, to have compulsory process for obtaining witnesses in his favor, and to have assistance of counsel for his defense. Now, without dealing with this amendment's unbiblical provision for juries again, because we've covered juries two or three times in the past already, let's scrutinize the first phrase of Amendment 6, where it says, in all criminal prosecutions, the accused shall enjoy the right of a speedy and public trial. Now, while this is admittedly a biblical principle, Ecclesiastes chapter 8 and verse 11, New American Standard Version for clarity's sake, says, because the sentence against an evil deed is not executed quickly, therefore the hearts of the sons of men among them are given fully to do evil. God intends that justice be executed quickly. But while a speedy trial is admittedly a biblical principle, it is unattainable under a non-biblical judicial system like we have thanks to the Constitution. And it's a vicious cycle that it's provided that cannot be remedied. Because today's non-biblical judiciary, to begin with, provides little or no deterrence to criminals, our court system is flooded with cases, and which makes it, as a result, impossible to have a speedy trial. When justice, now think about this, when justice is not carried out quickly, criminals, rather than being deterred, are animated in their criminal behavior. Isn't that what we just read? Listen to Ecclesiastes chapter 8 and verse 11 again. Capital punishment is not a deterrent unless it's carried out swiftly. Ecclesiastes 8:11, because a sentence against an evil deed is not executed quickly, therefore the hearts of the sons of men among them are given fully to do evil. Consequently, the more criminals, as a result of no deterrence, because the courts are already slow, here's the cycle, the vicious cycle. Consequently, the more criminals, the more flooded are courts. And the more flooded are courts, the slower the justice. And the slower justice, the less deterrence. And the less deterrence, the more criminals. And the more flooded are courts. And on and on and on it goes. In this vicious cycle that can never be remedied in our situation as it is. Further exasperating the problem is today's appellate system, which you certainly cannot find in the Bible either, which allows convicted criminals to appeal numerous times, spanning sometimes several years. 10 years, for example, in Ted Bundy's case. 10 years till by the time that someone like Bundy is finally put to death, the deterrent is all but lost upon the generation most familiar with the case. And thus, more criminals, more flooding, more time, less deterrence, more criminals, and society falls apart because there is no justice in the land. For this reason, as well as the fact that our justice is not governed by Yahweh's perfect laws and his perfect justice. But under Yahweh's system, his kingdom, there's far less crime to begin with. All apprehended criminals are immediately brought to trial. And if determined guilty, if he's a capital criminal, he's immediately and publicly executed. And if he's a non-capital criminal, he immediately pays restitution plus 2 to 5 times more to his victim. And if he cannot pay, he is immediately put into indentured servitude until his debt is paid off to the victim. Which also means that there is absolutely no need for taxed, subsidized prisons under Yahweh's perfect laws and his perfect system. Because by his perfect laws, there's no one to put in prison. And therefore, you don't have to tax subsidize to feed and entertain and take care of these guys. It's time. Man, is it time. Christians. It's time for Christians to begin believing that Yahweh knows best. And that his laws truly are perfect for every facet of life. All right, with that, Amendment 8. Excessive bail shall not be required, nor excessive fines imposed, nor cruel and unusual punishments inflicted. All right, it begins by saying excessive bail shall not be required. Bail? Where in Yahweh's laws do you find anything about a bail? Or about bail? Nowhere. Why not? Because bail is only necessary in an imperfect, slow, overloaded judicial system. That's the only place that bail is needed. Under Yahweh's system, because justice is meted out swiftly, there are less criminals. And because there are less criminals, either because of deterrence or because all convicted capital criminals the first time are put to death, the courts are not flooded. And consequently, there is absolutely no cause or reason for bail. And therefore, you can't find it in God's Word. But what about Amendment 8's provision for no excessive fines? Now, that sounds like a pretty good idea. No excessive fines. Except for the fact that is totally unbiblical. To begin with, where in Yahweh's laws is anything ever said about paying fines to the state? Because that's included, if not primary, in that particular amendment statement. The only thing close to that is found in Leviticus 5 and Numbers 5. Let's turn to Leviticus 5 to begin with. Leviticus 5, and look at verses 15 and 16 with me. Verse 15, it says, if a soul commit a trespass and sin through ignorance in the holy things of Yahweh, then he shall bring for his trespass unto Yahweh a ram without blemish out of the flocks, with the estimation by shekels of silver, after the shekel of the sanctuary, for a trespass offering. And he shall make amends for the harm that he has done in the holy thing, and shall add the fifth part thereto, and give it unto the priest. And the priest shall make an atonement for him with the ram of the trespass offering, and it shall be forgiven him. All right, the guilt offering or its estimation in silver were types of Yahshua and his new covenant sacrifice and are therefore no longer required under the new covenant. Yahshua has covered that part of it. But the principle, there still has to be the application of the case law as it would apply otherwise. And therefore the principle and the added 20% are still required. But somebody's going to ask, well, but who do we pay today? Well, we'll get to that. Turn over to Numbers chapter 5 now. Numbers chapter 5. Now, restitution, what we're going to find here is that restitution is required even when the victim cannot be identified. Numbers 5, specifies to whom the restitution must be paid when the offended party cannot be found, is no longer living, or and is without any known living relatives. Let's look at it. Numbers chapter 5, picking it up with verse 5 and reading through verse 8. It says, "And Yahweh spake unto Moses, saying, Speak unto the children of Israel, when a man or woman shall commit any sin that men commit to do a trespass against Yahweh, and that person be guilty, then they shall confess their sin which they have done, and he shall recompense his trespass with the principal thereof, and add unto it the fifth part thereof, and give it unto him against whom he has trespassed." Notice, the victim gets paid, not the state. Verse 8, "But if a man have no kinsman to recompense the trespass unto, let the trespass be recompensed unto Yahweh, even to the priest, beside the ram of the atonement, whereby an atonement shall be made for him." Now, I'm stretching it even some to say if there's fines at all, even in Yahweh's perfect laws, these are the two closest thing that come to fines, because it does go to what might be called state representatives or government representatives to the priests and the Levites. Even if the thief repents and is granted forgiveness by Yahweh, the requirement of restitution certainly remains the same. But again, to whom? We don't have the priesthood like they had then, the Levitical system that the government workers of that day. Well, today, in the absence of the temple or Levitical priest, restitution should be given to, now listen to this, to a church or a ministry. To any church or ministry? Absolutely not. But to a church or a ministry that teaches Yahweh's laws and promotes His kingdom here on earth as it is in heaven. And here's the biblical precedent for doing so. In 2 Chronicles chapter 31 declares that one of the purposes of tithes and offerings is for furthering Yahweh's laws and His, and therefore His kingdom. Let me just read it to you. 2 Chronicles 31, verse 4. It says, "Moreover, he commanded the people that dwelt in Jerusalem to give the portion of the priest and the Levites." And the portion of the priest and the Levites, that would include those two cases in Leviticus 5 and Numbers 5 as well. The restitution required in those instances. And then it says that, here gives, providing the reason, that they might be encouraged in, or the New American Standard says, that they might devote themselves to the law of Yahweh. End of that quote. In other words, very clearly, antinomians do not deserve anyone's tithe or offerings. Yeah, but we don't have any priests or Levites today. We'll turn to 2 Kings chapter 4 and verse 42. I think you'll find this interesting. 2 Kings chapter 4. And very quickly look at verse 42 with me. And it says, "And there came a man from Baalah Shalisha, and brought," now listen to this, "and brought the man of God." The man of God in this instance is the prophet Elisha. "And there came a man from Baalah Shalisha, and brought the man of God bread of the first fruits." 20, now who did the first fruits belong to? First fruits belong to the Levites and the priests. But here we have it being given to Elisha the prophet. 20 loaves of barley and the full ears of corn and the husk thereof, and he said, "Give unto the people that they may eat." Now, there were no Levites at that time in the land to which to give the first fruits. And in their absence, Baalah Shalisha brought his first fruits to the prophet, or if you will, the preacher, Elisha instead, setting a biblical precedent. The Apostle Paul provides new covenant precedent for the same. Turn over to 1 Corinthians chapter 9. Not to labor you down with all of this technical stuff, but it's important that we see what should be done in these instances and how it should be done, in of course contrast to constitutional law. 1 Corinthians chapter 9, verse 7. Beginning, it says, "Who goeth to war for any time at his own charges? Who planteth a vineyard and eateth not the fruit thereof? Or who feedeth a flock and eateth not the milk of the flock? Say I these things as a man, or saith not the law the same also? For it is written in the law of Moses, Thou shalt not muzzle the mouth of the ox that treadeth out the corn." In other words, the ox. God provided for the ox, did he not? And he says, while he's plowing, while he's going through the corn, not plowing, but when he's harvesting, pulling the harvester or whatever is necessary, you've got to let him eat if he wants to eat. He says, "Thou shalt not muzzle the mouth of the ox that treadeth out the corn." Doth God take care for oxen? Well, obviously he did, but Paul makes the point. "Or saith he it altogether?" In other words, more so, "For our sakes, no doubt this is written, that he that ploweth should plow in hope, and that he that thresheth in hope should be partaker of his hope." Now catch the application here. Verse 11, "If we have sown unto you spiritual things, is it a great thing if we shall reap your carnal or material things?" Paul is talking about him and the other apostles and the other disciples and preachers who were out preaching, sharing the gospel. He says, "If we have sown unto you spiritual things, is it a great thing if we shall reap unto you material things?" And particularly verse 13, he says, "Do you not know that they which minister about holy things live of the things of the temple?" Referring back to the temple. He's using it and applying it now, using that typology and applying it to New Covenant times. Now, who's he referring to when he says, "Do you not know that they which minister about holy things live of the things of the temple?" Well, he's talking about the priests and Levites. And what were the things, continuing that verse, "And they which wait at the altar are partakers with the altar." So what were the things of the temple and the things of the altar? What did they partake of? The tithes and offerings. In those days, brought as either vegetables and fruit and animals. Verses 13 and 14 together, it says, now catch all of this. It says, "Do you not know that they which minister about holy things live of the things of the temple?" And this is his basis for applying this. "And they which wait at the altar are partakers with the altar." Verse 14, "Even so hath the Lord ordained." There's a new covenant application for the tithes and the offerings here. "Even so has the Lord ordained that they which preach the gospel shall live by the gospel." Now, somebody will quickly point out that doesn't want to pay tithes and offerings, say, well, Paul didn't take advantage of that. He did not take advantage of it from the Corinthians because he was being paid by other churches to do so, to be able to do what he was doing. But there is the principle. Now, don't forget, back to verse 14, he says, "Even so has the Lord ordained that they which preach the gospel shall live by the gospel." Important point. Don't forget that the gospel is not simply the gospel. That almost sounds strange, but here's what I mean by that. It's unquestionably, first and foremost, the gospel. The death is the death, burial, resurrection, and appearance of Christ, as per Paul, as he described in 1 Corinthians 15, 1 through 5. But what Paul describes in 1 Corinthians 15, 1 through 5, that is only the hub of the wheel, if you will, from which the spokes of the gospel come from. That is the core, that's the hub, that's the foundation, but that's all it is. There's much more to the gospel than just the death, burial, resurrection, and appearance of Christ. The gospel is identified 4 times in the Gospels of Matthew and Mark as the gospel of the kingdom. And you can see the spokes going out from the hub. But it goes out and it includes much more when you consider it from that terminology. The gospel of the kingdom and thus the gospel of Yahweh's laws. Consequently, tithes and offerings do not belong to anyone who is not preaching the gospel of the kingdom here on earth where his laws can be applied. He doesn't need it up there, it's already taken care of up there. Which, of course, then rules out everyone in government today, constitutionalists, and the vast majority of today's preachers. It's essentially the same thing that Paul deals with, and a little bit broader, and applications out here a little bit further, that Paul dealt with in Romans 13:7, where he says, "Render therefore all their dues, tribute to whom tribute is due." New American Standard says, "Tax to whom tax is due. Custom to whom custom, fear to whom fear, honor to whom honor." And who did Paul say that tribute and tax was due? It's right there in the context, verses 3 and 4. Ministers of God. Ministers used very broadly, not as we normally think of it in a church setting, but ministers of God, but it would include them as well in this case. Ministers of God for good to the righteous and who strike fear in the hearts of the wicked. Wonder how they do that. With God's laws, with His perfect laws, and His judgments, which are righteous altogether. That's where the kind of fines, if you will, described in Leviticus 5 and Numbers 5 should go. Those are the only things in God's Word that are come close to the types of fines referred to in Amendment 8. But what if Amendment 8 is referring to fines paid to victims? And I think it does sometimes refer to that as well. Well, think about this. Because it does not specify Exodus 22, etc., as the guidelines as to what is appropriate for quote-unquote fines, so you can bet that the government would rule that 4 to 5 times restitution would be excessive. You can just bet that would be the case, and especially if it goes to the victims rather than the state. They're going to rule against it. So again, we can see the unbiblical nature of this amendment in that regard. And if not, think about this, if not Exodus 22 and similar statutes, then we should be asking, well, who gets to decide what's excessive or not? Might change with any given generation, too. What might have been excessive may not be excessive. What is excessive may not be excessive. And any change in time when man decides otherwise, whoever it is who gets to decide. Well, I'll tell you who does. Who gets to decide. It's the same who also gets to decide what's cruel and unusual punishment when it comes to capital punishment. It's the same ones. And in case you haven't figured it out, under constitutional government, it is not Yahweh, but another deity known as we the people, or their representatives, or ultimately 5 Supreme Court justices. Something, in fact, if you've been listening to the news here lately, they're deliberating on. The Supreme Court is deliberating on right now as it concerns lethal injection. Whether now all suddenly that's cruel and unusual. But that aspect of the amendment, we'll have to wait until the next message. And it's in fact something very important that indeed needs to be addressed. And one of those key points in the Constitution that shows how diabolically opposed it is. Not only opposed to Yahweh's laws in this case, but even condemning of Yahweh. So we'll begin our next message with that particular statement and amendment, the last clause, I believe, of Amendment 8. All right, let's stand. We'll close this one in prayer. Heavenly Father, we come before you one more time. We thank you and glorify you, Lord, today again in Yahshua the Christ, for him, Father, as our Redeemer, for the grace and mercy you give us in him, Lord, for our justification comes by him and not by your law. But Father, we thank you for your law, that it can be applied in society, in our own lives, that we